And in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make.
Sang out a tune, would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song, and I'll try not to sing out of key. Oh, I get by with a little help from my friend. I get high with a little help from my friend. Gonna try with a little help from my friend.
Welcome to Acoustic Sailing. I'm Vin Magazzini. It's 4 o'clock, 4:04 to be exact, and Candy Leonard is here with me, and Prudence. They're in the studio with me. I'm taking calls, 617-627-3800. That is the number to call, and I would love to hear from you. It's an hour of the Beatles.
Extraordinaire. Your tour here in Los Angeles is drawing to a close. I wonder if you have any particular comments to make about your visit to Los Angeles, John.
Well, it's been great and thrilling, you know, and we saw a couple of film stars, which we wanted to do, you know. And it's just great, and the bowl was marvelous.
What did you think about the audience and the way they... most of the people, there were more than 17,000 persons in the Hollywood Bowl, and of course, not all of them teenagers, but for the most part, they were young adults and your fans. I wonder, you'd care to comment on the way they conducted themselves the night of your performance.
Well, it was so good. It was almost too well behaved, you know.
Too well behaved. That's John Lennon there, right there. And he's talking about the Hollywood Bowl, the bowl he talked about. Well, folks, it's always a good day, sunshine, to have Candy Leonard on with us at WMFO. May I introduce to you Candy Leonard. Welcome to the program. And you are on the air. Go ahead.
Is this on?
Yes, you're on, yes. You are.
Well, thanks for inviting me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you back. This is Candy Leonard's second time on the show, and we're just thrilled to have her. So, Candy, what's new with you?
Well, my book, Beatleness, How the Beatles and Their Fans Remade the World, just came out in paperback. So that's pretty exciting.
What's the publishing on that?
It's published by Arcade Publishers, a division of Skyhorse Publishing. And yeah, it came out in August of 2014, hardcover, and it just came out in paperback. So that's pretty exciting. It's kind of another opportunity to get out there and talk about it and introduce people to what is widely recognized, and I'm happy it is, as a very different kind of Beatles book, because it's not... It goes through the familiar story that we all know so well from the early days up until the breakup. But it looks at this familiar story from the fan perspective. So instead of the fans reading about it and kind of looking at it through a window, the fan is the center of attention. And I look at how a generation of baby boomers reacted to the Beatles record by record by record as it came out. So it's kind of a different take on it. And it really shows how they... changed everything. You know, you always hear people saying, oh, the Beatles changed everything. So by doing in-depth interviews with fans who were there, mm-hmm. about 150 fans or so were interviewed for the book, you can see how they really, in fact, did change everything, because they changed these young people now in their 50s and 60s, some early 70s. So that's what the book is about.
Yeah, and what I love is how you take people talking about their experiences, their view of the Beatles and what they went through, and at the same time, in my head, I clearly remember listening to their music. And for me, the Beatles were already broke up by when I turned 5 years old. They were part of history. So I would get their albums, I would read about them, and especially their albums, I would hear their songs, and wow, when I saw the Red and the Blue album, and these are the same people on the stairs, you know, on the fire escape, I guess it is, right? Or actually, they're leaning over the
railing.
The railing. Yes,
it's actually EMI's main offices.
Right. They're, and you see them, and they're in the very spots that they were once before, in the same pose. And it's like, these are those people. What has happened during those years? It's fascinating. And
well, you know, when people come to the Beatles after the fact and they hear the wide range of different sounds and different styles and different periods, and they hear them all kind of, you know, not in order, it's a very different experience than those of us who had the privilege, the good fortune of growing up with them and watching that unfold. And, you know, so I'll never forget this last year. It was really interesting. I was with a young person who was hearing Tomorrow Never Knows for the first time and was just completely blown away.
That's great.
And, you know, as... exciting as that song was to him in 2015, it's the experience of hearing it for the first time before the world was Beatleized, before anybody heard it. In other words, as it came out, when it was brand new, was an experience that was truly mind-blowing.
Sure, and can I ask you, what was your opinion when you? How old were you when you first heard it, and what was your opinion of it?
Tomorrow Never Knows in particular, you're asking me?
Yes.
Well, it's on Revolver, so I was 10.
Wow. And what did you think of it?
Well, I remember thinking it was different than the Beatles that I knew, but I was aware that they were changing, even with Rubber Soul. I mean, because with Rubber Soul already, it was a little more serious, seemed a little more grown up, you know. When Revolver came out, I mean, I remember, of course, Yellow Submarine being the exception. I still see it as, like, why is it even on that record? But that's another conversation. It was becoming very sophisticated for young fans. You know, people forget that a lot of first-generation fans were children, like I was.
Oh, sure.
I was 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a lot to absorb because, you know, by that point it had been about a year and a half they'd been in our life, and we're following the music, listening so closely, and you know, filled with anticipation for the next thing they were going to do.
Right.
And then it was Revolver, which was a lot for a lot of young fans. But I imagine, I do remember thinking it was a little strange. But I was up for it. I mean, I was open-minded.
You're pretty open-minded for a 10-year-old.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, as I said, there was a kind of a reservoir of trust built up between the Beatles and the fans. So even if something was a little different,
it was
really the cusp where, as I said, Rubber Soul really started to be more sophisticated and a little bit different, grown-up sounding. But it was still kind of within the bounds of
pop
things we'd heard, right?
Yes.
Whereas you can't say that so much about Revolver because it was, you know, it was the whole psychedelic thing and all that. And so it was very different. But for a lot of young fans, as luck would have it, the Monkees came along, you know, a month later.
That's right.
Their TV show debuted. And so a lot of fans who maybe were feeling that the Beatles had, you know, were moving too fast or they weren't, for whatever reason, didn't embrace it. The Monkees kind of filled that void for those young music fans. But of course, the Monkees also communicated this kind of countercultural message that the Beatles were communicating at that point. So even though you were not a Beatle fan, you were still getting, not as if you weren't a fan, but maybe you put them on the back burner a little bit when they started to change, you were still getting that, you know, as I say, the countercultural messages from the Monkees.
I mean, the one thing that's wonderful for me about the book is about how the fans were sometimes scared at what the Beatles were doing and sometimes wondering, what's going on here? What is that sound? What is that instrument? And a very, you know, refreshing thing to read about in terms of the whole Beatle experience.
Well, we take it very much for granted now. I mean, but think about a song. Not that we take it for granted and that we don't appreciate it, but what we take for granted is how different it was because we're used to it now. I've been hearing it for 50 plus years, but you know, Strawberry Fields is particularly jarring for fans because not only was the sound different, but they looked different. That was the first time we saw them with facial hair.
Absolutely.
And that was a very, very big deal. A lot of fans, not only young fans, but a lot of fans of all ages didn't like it. But many older fans were thrilled with the facial hair because they took it as the Beatles being on the side of young people in the prevailing generation gap and all the things that were happening in the culture at the time. The Beatles with facial hair told college students and older high school students, you know, this is, you know, we're with you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you know how that's, I'm sorry, I just want to jump. Do you know how that started, the facial hair?
Yes. I know the story. Go ahead, Jim. Sorry, Prudence.
Yes, Prudence. Paul was riding motor scooter with Tara Brown, who became the day in the life, John sang about that. Paul took a turn too wide and
took a tumble,
skidded on his face. This is according to his brother, who was there, and he had a big scar on his lip, and you can see a chipped tooth in one video. And so he grew a mustache to cover the scar, and they all did what the other ones did, and that's how that started.
And that little scar on his lip remains.
You have to look.
Well,
very
you can,
close.
You can
very
see
close.
It yeah, in absolutely. The paperback writer
and
Rain
and the chipped tooth in that. Yeah,
it's
yeah.
pretty clear. And of course, it was that accident that was referred to when the whole Paul is dead rumor started
Stupid bloody
in '69.
Tuesday. Yeah.
That it was, you know, that was kind of looked back at the you know, see he's something different about
right,
it.
Right. That's right.
So today we're going to right now play something from the Beatles' end of their career, and then we're going to scoot back to the beginning, sort of, and then we're going to go to 50 years ago and hear some obscure demos, and we're going to keep the microphones on live, so here we go. It's the Beatles, and it's Beatleness.
Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she doesn't have a lot to say. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she changes from day to day. I wanna tell her that I love her a lot, but I gotta get a belly full of wine. My Majesty's a pretty nice girl, someday I'm gonna make her mine, oh yeah, someday I'm gonna make her mine.
And that's a funny little boom there, and it's the Beatles. Okay, hold on a second. I have an obscure Beatles song you probably have never, ever heard coming up in just a moment. Ready, boys? Here we go. Here are the Beatles back in the mid-60s. No, sorry. Rats. Hold on a second, folks. I have some serious Beatles coming your way, and so I will get it properly done. And in the meantime, check this out. It's the Beatles, and they're here just for you and yours. WMFO, here are the Beatles. Check this out.
He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land, making all his nowhere plans for nobody.
What he wants to
telling all my friends I'm in love. That's John Lennon of the Beatles. And did you ever hear that song, Candy?
I have not heard it.
Isn't it lovely?
It's great.
It really is.
I mean, his voice is just incredible. When you hear these stories about how he didn't like his voice.
I know. Yeah. I can't believe that either.
He's got one of the best rock and roll voices.
I know.
It's a gorgeous voice, and he could sing, and it was distinctive, and
till the end of his life, from the first time he met Paul, at least deep down, there was always competition or comparison that he had with Paul. And it because they were so close, triggered his insecurity. It would push some insecure buttons in John.
Well, they both had great voices.
But
very different.
But John, from the time, the thing that Yoko took over their finances started because John felt Paul had so much money, and why don't I have as much money as Paul? And they're discussing that, and we can't trust anybody to handle our money, so Yoko did it. Although to her emotional detriment, she was really an artist, and she stopped making art for a while, and that got her down. But anyway, Paul was inside John from the first time in John's mind.
Yeah, their relationship was extraordinary.
Yes, yes.
And I think there's a lot there that has not been explored, actually.
In what sense?
In their relationship, I think that there's a depth to it and and an ebb and flow and a dynamic that, in some sense, it was all very public and played out, but I think there's just some interesting aspects to it. I don't know.
Oh, yes. No, I think that's true. And in fact, there was a TV movie that came out in about 2000. They recently showed it again on a new network called Decades. I think Vinny saw it.
Just the two of us?
The two of us. Did you see that?
I did.
Did you like it? I loved it. I
don't remember what I thought at the time. I think I liked it.
I thought it was beautiful.
I think I liked it.
I was very touched by it.
It was fictionalized, right?
Yes, but Paul would show up at the Dakota. In fact,
right.
John mentions it in the last interview with Playboy.
Right. In fact, in the recent interview with Paul that he did for the BBC a week or two ago, he talked about how things between them had become kind of more normalized and comfortable,
and
that their friendship was. Of course, you never know with Paul. You know, he tends a little bit towards revisionist history.
Well, John would too, and although he didn't think he was, his stories would tend to change if he looked at all his interviews, and he did many of them. But Paul is getting more. I mean, he didn't want to talk about the Beatles, but as anything with John, depending on what day you met him, he could be, particularly to Paul, really rude. And the last time they spoke, according to Paul, was Paul called him up. Paul was in New York, had his guitar with him, called John up to see if he'd come over. And John said, Paul says Paul. And John said, what do you want on the phone? And they had a few words. Paul got mad. And Paul said in his interview, John, being in New York for so long, he sounded like Kojak. He was like this tough kid. So I said, F you, Kojak, and hang up the phone the last time they talked.
Yeah,
really?
it's very sad.
Great guy, but mercurial is...
Well, yeah, that, and also, I think there's a great quote, a quote of him saying, we're not in Liverpool anymore, Paul.
Yeah,
so,
but he could be cruel at times.
Sure. But I'm just saying, that was his take on the whole thing, and... I actually love his quote when everyone said, get back together with the Beatles. And he would say, I'll get back together with the Beatles as soon as you
go back to high school.
Yeah. That's a wonderful quote.
Yeah.
And that's John. And we're going to take a break now.
That's his way of saying. He was done.
Yes, absolutely. And we're going to play a PSA.
Let's go inside the mind of a 10-year-old.
I should have worn those earrings today. I like those earrings. Gabby has those awesome earrings. I need to ask her where she got those, but that's just what she would want me to do. I'll have Michaela ask her for me.
Buckle up, Sarah.
Yeah, but then Michaela will be like, why don't you just ask her yourself? That's just like Michaela.
Sarah, buckle up.
Michaela's such a great name. I wish I was called Michaela. There's like a dozen Sarahs in my class.
Hey, we're not hitting the road until you buckle up, honey.
Oh yeah, seatbelt. I forget sometimes because my brain is like busy, you know? I wonder if there's pizza at school today.
Sometimes it can be tough to get through to your kids, but it's not impossible. Always make sure they're wearing their seatbelts, even on short drives. Remember, you have the keys, you have the power. Never give up until they buckle up. A message from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council. Visit safercar.gov/kidsbuckleup for more information.
And this is live radio. This is WMFO in Medford, and we're going to talk about this song. This is John Lennon performing slash demoing She Said for the probably the first time ever in the studio. Check this out. And now, here we go. There's more. There's lots more.
He said, did he? Oh, that's very nice, isn't he?
What else did he say, hello? John?
Okay.
He said, I know what it's like to be dead. I said, I must be out of my head.
And if you hear the song, it slowly starts dripping out, almost like molasses coming out of his voice, and it turns into the magnificent She Said, all from this little folk song, almost like a skiffle type of song, She Said on acoustic. Yeah, and yeah. Here, and here's John really flushing, you know, getting the song to come alive.
I know what it's like to be dead. I know what it's like to be sad.
It became more melodic.
And so that's the making of She Said, and then obviously it turned into this. One of my very favorite Beatles songs there, and that all came from this. Feel like my trousers were torn and everything was right.
I wonder how it switched from he to she.
You noticed that, right? She said. Mm. I mean, lovely, lovely. Little more. I have to play more of this demo. And that's John Lennon, of course, of the Beatles, singing She Said. And obviously it turned into, what do you know, this.
Everything was right. I said.
It's one thing about John. I love the fact that it was so personal to him. So many of his songs are from I said, I did, in my life, I love you more.
Don't Let Me Down.
Absolutely.
Well,
I mean, you can go on and
that
on.
That is commonly attributed to Dylan.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And Paul would be, I don't know if it's more Mozart or less romantic or whatever, but still brilliant, and be more of what is happening. A feeling of suddenly, I'm not half the man I used to be yesterday, came suddenly. I mean, brilliant. And mm-hmm. But I wonder, is it more about the feeling of, you know, melancholy, a feeling of being wistful?
For who?
For Paul, in the sense of less of like, this is my street, this is my feeling of being nowhere. As a nowhere man.
It's more
man.
Like he's telling a story than telling his own story.
Right, exactly.
But
it's within, less of a biography.
Subtly giving clues about himself.
I mean,
that was Paul.
You know, Father McCartney wiping his hands as he leaves from the graves. It becomes Father McCartney. And it's still brilliant. Father McKenzie, sorry.
Pete Shotton said that he gives a detailed account of the making of that song, the recording of that song.
Mm-hmm.
Not the recording, but the writing of Eleanor Rigby. Pete Shotton, who's John's friend from the time he was five till the end.
Yeah, I just think with the juggernaut, which was the Beatles, it's the yin and the yang, mm-hmm. you know, the two of them complementing each other so
well. Well, I think that's part of their appeal, because each one, their voices are different, their world views were different, their psyches were different, their childhoods were very different, mm-hmm. and so you have this very, between the two of them, you have this very, very wide palette mm-hmm. of human emotion, but you know, two halves making a very, very large whole. And I think that's part of the appeal, because it taps into so many experiences that people have, mm-hmm. and so it's just a very full, rich amalgam of those two beings.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I think it's true how John and Paul really drove the train. I mean, George and Ringo were part of it, and they helped it succeed in every which way. But as George lovingly said, George and Ringo were second-class Beatles. Not a second-class. They were economy-class Beatles. That was a wonderful way that George said it. And I think it's very much true. And
did he say that?
At some point in his life.
Because
I have
during
no
the Beatles, there was resentment against John and Paul for how he was treated. Yeah.
Sure. But it is a wonderful economy-class Beatle. If you're gonna be any kind of Beatle, you're doing something right. And he edged up to the first class by the end of the Beatles.
I would say so.
We have a little more of a John Lennon interview, and then we're back with Candy Leonard on WMFO in Medford.
There was a big thing called skiffle, which is a kind of folk music, American folk music, and he sort of jing 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 with washboards. Mm-hmm. And all the kids, you know, 15 onwards, used to have these groups, and I formed one at school. And then I met Paul, you know, I had this group, and then I met Paul, then I met George, and that's the way it went. We changed to rock. And that was all there was to it.
When did you cut your first record?
I have no clue. That must be about 1.5 years, 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. What was the reaction to it publicly in England?
It only sold in Liverpool. Over the rest of Britain, it didn't, you know, nobody bought it there. About half a dozen people did. But it sold so many in Liverpool the first 2 days, because they were all waiting for us to make it. Mm-hmm. That the dealers down in London thought there's a fiddle on. That Mr. Epstein fella up there is cheating, you know. They didn't believe it. When they wrote in requests for it for the radio programs, they wouldn't play it, because they thought it was a cheat. Because all the requests and everything came from Liverpool.
Now, here in the United States, and in Los Angeles in particular, there are, well, the music lists on most of the radio stations that play Beatle music are predominantly Beatle records. Now, is this the same situation in England? Do they play several of your hits at one time, or do they just play one or two records? Whereas we have maybe a half a dozen or more at one time on the charts.
No, they never do that, because, well, not on the sort of BBC. The commercial radio doesn't either. They always give equal sort of spots to everybody. The only time you get more than one track usually is when they're playing LPs.
And that's John Lennon back in the mid-60s talking about Beatle music, and guess what? We're talking about the Beatles and Beatleness. We have Candy Leonard here in the studio with us. She's author of Beatleness, The Fan's Eye View. Candy Leonard. The book is out on Arcade Publishing, and you can find it at all the
wherever books are sold or Amazon. Porter Square Books has a few, I think.
Harvard Bookstore probably.
I think the Coop has one or two. I mean, just thinking real locally, but you can get it on Amazon. Yeah, the paperback is a little, it has a new preface, and it has discussion questions in case people want to use it in, you know, teachers want to use it in a classroom, or if you, have a book group and you read it. And the discussion questions are organized for, like, different ages and things.
One of the questions is, were the Beatles agents of change, or were they a reflection of changes already happening in the culture? Candy Leonard, what do you think about that?
Candy, what do you think about that?
Well, I think it was both. They were young with it. They were they knew what was going on in art, in music, in fashion, and of course they had money to explore all their whims and interests and things. So, you know, the things that they were into and discovered, whether it was music or meditation or Carnaby Street fashion, they brought that to the largest demographic group that ever existed in the history of the world, not only here but in Europe as well. So whatever they were into, their ideas, their worldview, which they imparted to this huge generation who was paying rapt attention to their every move.
And could afford to buy the records.
Right, exactly. It was, the economy was good. People were buying records. And, you know, you could go into Woolworths and buy a 45 for, 59 or 69 cents. And you could have a transistor radio, which was your constant companion, right? You know, this was the first in a long line of personal listening devices. But young Beatle fans would go into the drugstore, you buy this transistor radio, it became your constant companion.
Yeah.
And so, you know, young people were so tuned into them. And as they started to evolve and become, their words and music became more sophisticated, the interviews, they became more outspoken. This huge generation watching this, like, we didn't miss a beat, you know.
Yeah.
And so they, you know, when they came out against the war, for example, young people who were confused about this whole Vietnam thing or civil rights or whatever the issues of the day, the Beatles became a focal point, and they were the sages that this generation really looked up to.
Yeah. Yeah. The book is Beatleness, How the Beatles and Their Fans Remade the World. And Beatleness is a word that Candy Leonard has trademarked. And one of the definitions is, Beatleness is an emotional or spiritual state, condition, or feeling resulting from exposure to or thinking about the Beatles and their works. I think that when I would say it to my uncles, like, "Oh, you saw the Beatles? You saw them at Suffolk Downs?" And they were like, "Yeah, I grew up with the Beatles." I got that many times, where people older than me, uncles, older people, whatever.
Me.
I should say baby boomers. I miss the baby boomers by a little bit, I think technically we are the last year of the baby boomers.
I think maybe a year late, 64. Does it go like the 47 to 64?
Well, according to
something
the demographers, you know, it ends in 64.
Okay, so we were a year late then.
Damn it.
But the whole thing, the reason I bring it up is because the Beatles in almost countless ways. I mean, literally dozens and dozens of ways the Beatles broke down doors. They were the first to do all these different things musically, or what a band does, what rock and roll does, what pop music is.
It was the
name it.
They were also, you know, it was the first time that young people had so much. These four young guys, they were like the princes of the world. They had so much power and so much wealth. And they were all anybody talked about, more or less, for 6 years, mm-hmm. right? And so they had this enormous power. And
they're part of the young generation, and they have something to say. Exactly. That's what the monkeys said, but in the Beatles, it was true about the Beatles, though. Right, they really did have something to say.
As soon as
and it was authentic. It was an authentic Liverpool slash British young person's point of view, slash young person's point of view. I mean, not just British.
Yeah, and they were intelligent and articulate, and they, when they were on Ed Sullivan, you know, which was an event that baby boomers remember vividly as a really kind of one of those before and after events, just from the first look at them, we had never seen people that looked like this before. And, of course, the music was incredible, but the overwhelming takeaway from that Sullivan performance was freedom, self-expression, youth empowerment, and fun and joy and just, wow, there's this big thing happening. They're all anybody talked about. Mm-hmm. I mean, not only, you know, you and your friends and kids in your block or your classroom or your neighborhood, but all over the country, all over the world, you know, people on TV were talking about them. They became a cultural frame of reference in a way that really nothing else has almost since. I mean, for the most part. I mean, it was an unprecedented media event as well that just went on for 6 years.
I mean, I love the fact that what they did exceptionally well. And it was music, it was writing. They ended up being pretty great actors in terms of Hard Day's Night. It's a wonderful film. Help is a lot of fun also.
Right. I mean, with Magical Mystery Tour, it was considered the Beatles' first flop. I mean, that was, you know, didn't get great, was not well received at the time. However, in retrospect, you know, looking back on it, Steven Spielberg and others look at that and say that they were inspired by it. And I mean, it was very much a product of the times. But it was, it was a little bit, it was the one thing that people look at and say it was not so great. But hey, when you consider their output over all those years and the quantity and the quality of their work, I mean, my God.
Off the air, Candy and I talked about it, how they were writing these original songs. No rock band slash pop band was doing that. They were putting albums out filled with original, instant classic songs. And to this day, over 50 years later, no one has topped those very performances. They had help. They had Brian Epstein in the early days that helped give them direction. They had George Martin in the studio helping shape their
just
sound.
Died a few months ago.
Absolutely. And yet these four guys, they had so much to offer that it's astounding.
It's the quantity of the quality. That's right. Really
sure.
What
absolutely
made them still special.
And with the and if you think about it today, with the ongoing, you know, 50 years on, still universal appeal across generations. I mean, it remains unprecedented.
Mm-hmm. The word that you used describing it earlier, I've heard many times reading many books about the Beatles, joy.
Oh, yeah, that's the word.
In fact, in some documentary, they're talking to a girl, appears to be at Shea Stadium, maybe before the concert, and it's funny because she has a very thick New York accent, but she says they bring such joy to everybody.
Right. Yeah, no,
beautiful.
They do. And, you know, the other thing that's often mentioned, particularly about the early days and that early gush of Beatlemania, joy, Beatleness, was that, you know, this performance on Ed Sullivan that I was talking about a few moments ago, this happened 79 days after the Kennedy assassination. So this was, you know, I mean, looking back on it, this is less than 3 months. For all intents and purposes, they happened at the same moment. And so people were really shaken up by this, of people of all ages. But young people, teenagers in particular, saw in the Beatles something that was lost with Kennedy, which was this forward-looking, fun,
positive,
youthful, youth ascendancy. You know, when Kennedy, you know, in his inaugural address talked about citizens of the world. I mean, the Beatles were citizens
sure.
of the world,
yeah.
you know. And where Kennedy talked about a new frontier, the Beatles seemed to represent a new frontier.
That's right, yeah.
So they kind of, you know, and as far as the press was concerned, it was much more fun to write about these four mop tops
right.
from Liverpool
right.
than to, you know,
Cuban
write about the Warren Commission
yeah. oh, yes.
or the civil rights legislation. You know, they were a fun diversion.
Right, yeah.
And but for young people, it was more than that. That
right.
they represented something that was really for and about
right.
the power of young people. Yeah.
Well, their second album, just coincidence, released in Britain on November 22nd, 1963,
right.
the day Kennedy was assassinated. Just,
right.
You know.
I mean, well, those two events will always be historically linked, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is WMFO in Medford. This is Acoustic Sailing. Thanks. Thank you for listening, everybody. We have a lot more with Candy Leonard. 617-627-3800 if you want to call in. That's 617-627-3800. You can hear this program on WMFO.org. It'll be archived for the next 2 weeks. You can also download it with the with the password freeform. If you go to WMFO download and then you just follow the instructions with the password freeform, you can download this program. We have a little trivia here. This is Beatles trivia. What do Strawberry Fields, Penny Lane, Here Come the Sun, and Bad Boy all have in common? And a little thinking music. Put your thinking caps on, everybody.
February.
We're back on the air, folks. Basically, put your thinking caps off. It was kind of a silly question. I'll say it a different way. What do Strawberry Fields Forever, Penny Lane, that was a Beatles single, Here Comes the Sun, Bad Boy, and what was the last one I said?
I think that was it.
And
it was four.
Yeah, let's say Maxwell Silverhammer.
Well, now you're just making things
yeah,
up.
I'm just making it up. Okay, but... Let me put it this way.
Four of them played on each of the songs.
No.
Candy, do you have a guess?
I have no idea.
Okay, let me put it this way. They're different from Yellow Submarine. They're different from Ticket to Ride.
They're different from every other song.
No. Did not achieve something that...
Oh, they didn't reach number one.
Exactly.
Yes.
None
what do I win?
Songs.
What do I win?
Yeah.
Neither did Nowhere Man. Neither did Yellow Submarine. Did Eleanor Rigby.
No, Yellow Submarine hit number one in England. Yes.
Right, in England.
It's right
yeah,
here.
Candy, don't be a buzz on Vinny's high.
Don't harsh my mellow. Is that what you're doing?
He stumped us.
No, the funny thing is, though, you hear songs like Here Come the Sun.
Yeah.
You hear,
Bad Boy was...
Of course. A Bad Boy, I just...
was not even a single,
yeah, it wasn't a single.
EP, probably.
I was just thinking of random Beatles songs.
But
there's
what?
So many wonderful Beatles songs, and Here Comes the Sun's one of them.
Yeah.
Obviously,
songs.
Penny
well, you know,
Lane.
The,
obviously, Strawberry Fields.
What prevented Penny Lane
one.
From being
it's like,
number
what,
one?
What? You know, this what? Is flipping wrong.
That's
I mean,
right.
Come on.
What record prevented Penny
it's
Lane from being number
about
one?
Here, what's interesting about Here Comes the Sun now is that that is the most streamed Beatles song on Spotify.
I didn't know that. Wow.
And that and Hey Jude are mm-hmm. the two. Mm.
Oh, by
two
the
babies.
Way, Michelle
yeah.
is not a number one hit by the Beatles.
Was that
and it's
released
one of
the, as a single?
I don't
oh,
know.
America,
if it was.
It's
I
difference
mean,
in America. Definitely.
I mean,
American
yesterday America. Technically wasn't a
right.
single in
Great
England.
Britain,
in
right.
England. It somehow became
right.
a single in the United
well,
States
because,
at one point and,
well,
and
because,
was number one.
Yeah, it's a great song. They
but the Beatles
money.
Number ones, they officially had 27.
Well, those are the ones that are on the CD.
They're on, yeah, exactly.
And the DVD
wait,
that came
Britain,
out.
Absolutely. In Great Britain or America or both?
One or the other or both, yeah.
Okay.
And
what song prevented Penny Lane from being number one?
I know,
one?
It's Engelbert
yeah,
Humperdinck.
Please release
Engelbert.
Me.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's just so strange to think. But there's so many. I bring up that song because look at some of the songs on Revolver.
Mm-hmm.
Look at let me try to think of
She said.
Taxman. Yeah. What about In My Life on Rubber Soul? These are songs that they weren't number one hits and they weren't even released as singles.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
For No One
it's
my favorite Paul. But in one of the books, I mean, many people have mentioned it, their contemporaries, other songwriters, were stunned at the stuff they just threw on albums.
Right.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing to what we're really talking about are deep cuts that were not singles. And getting back to the Spotify data, it's very interesting because a lot of the songs that are streaming by people of all ages, around the world, tend to be the hits.
Hmm.
And so there's a lot of deep cuts that people don't know, even people who are think that they know the Beatles and are getting
right.
or maybe just learning about the Beatles.
That's right.
Because the whole concept of an album doesn't really exist anymore.
Yeah,
right?
A lot of things have changed.
So
yeah.
If you're coming to the Beatles new, as a young person, you're going to start with those hits.
Right.
And you might say, oh my God, I've been hearing that song forever. I didn't realize it was the Beatles. But will these younger, new listeners ever find For No One or I'll Follow the Sun or who knows?
Or the song that was played at my wedding as my wedding song, Here, There, and Everywhere.
Right, that was at my wedding too.
Oh, that was my mine because I haven't been married.
You know,
gorgeous
that
song.
That's Paul's favorite song when asked to name
really?
His favorite.
Oh, yeah. And it's one of John's favorite of Paul's.
I was about to say that. Yeah, I read that John said that he was very he admired that song quite a bit. That's right.
Said Revolver was he liked Paul's songs on that, said to Paul more than his, and then Shut Up, and Paul said, why? Like, what?
Yeah, as recently as last week there was an interview with Paul.
Okay, we have a caller. This is WMFO in Medford, and you are the first caller, and don't swear, you are on the air. Hi caller. Hello, who's this? Brian?
Yeah, what's up,
Brian? What's going on?
You're
on the air.
I just wanted to answer her question, what can kids find the song? Well, if they're listening to WMFO, all those deep cuts are on rotation.
Okay, good.
When you listen to Automation.
And it's funny, the Beatles and the Stones were played more than any artist last year. Right, Brian? Remember that?
On Automation, yeah.
On a WMFO.
Really?
Yeah.
Right, well, good for you.
Yeah.
I guess.
We keep it up, and we definitely love the deep cut.
All right, Brian, any other words of wisdom?
No, I'm just listening. Great show, man.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right.
Adios.
Candy, you wanted Paul had an interview recently?
No, I was saying about that he was asked again about his favorite of all the songs he's written,
mm-hmm.
and there's been, not only with the Beatles, but as
sure.
a solo artist.
Yes.
Thousands of songs.
Yes.
And he identified Here, There, and Everywhere.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
As his own favorite of his own work. He's got a lot to be proud of.
Oh, yeah. He was talking about, he was saying sometimes he sits back and does think and thinks, I think I did all right. You know, as a kid from Liverpool, I've done so well, and I never hurt anybody.
Right,
mm-hmm. And it's through music that I did this. I didn't hurt anybody or anything like that. He said, "No, it's not bad."
Amazing.
And he was a genius, unlike what some people.
And he's apparently
that
a nice
John
guy
was
too.
A genius. Yeah, they. You know what? Basically, they all ended up being just really good guys.
I think all four.
Yeah,
were very decent men.
Yes.
And,
yes. Flawed, but like everybody.
One thing that, getting back to the music, in the Summer of Love chapter is a quote from a male who was born in 1958.
What book is that from, Vin?
This is from Beatleness, Candy Leonard's latest book, How the Beatles and Their Fans Remade the World. Beatleness, The Fans' Eye View. Not everyone was listening to the same thing anymore. There were many options. Cream, Hendrix, Simon & Garfunkel, The Doors, The Monkees. But the Beatles were a common denominator, regardless of what else do you listen to. And I think in many ways the Beatles are something parents and kids agree on. I think many generations have embraced them.
Not at the time, that was not necessarily true.
Well, that was just the teenagers amongst themselves chatting about it.
Absolutely.
And somehow we came back to that, I think, many years later. I remember our high school principal talked about Todd, the valedictorian, how he loved the Beatles, and our high school principal said, well, I love the Beatles. Who doesn't love the Beatles?
Oh, he said that?
At our graduation.
Right. Well, that's true. That's true now.
That just stuck in my head.
I mean, anybody who doesn't like the Beatles now is either has a character flaw or is just being a contrarian.
I completely agree.
That's true. That is true.
And you can quote Candy Leonard on that, by the way.
Quote Candy Leonard.
Yes.
Author of Beatleness.
And we have her in the studio. And, John, what do you have to say?
One particular thing that you can lay your finger on that was the big break for you and your success today?
I haven't a clue. Probably just making the second record when it was number one.
Just your constant persistence and just keeping on with it.
I don't know. Like, we didn't even think of it like that. We just thought we were making another record and it was better than the first one. Let's see what it does, you know.
Let's see what it does.
The casualness, the coolness that they have. Like,
but I think they surprised themselves in so many ways. When Brian said you'll be bigger than Elvis, you know, you'll make it in America, I think the four of them were really like, is that possible? I mean, yeah. I can imagine them.
Sure. I mean, I think that they had the confidence, but, you know, they sort of didn't want to jinx it by agreeing or saying it out loud.
Well,
but
also, they were from Liverpool, and if you got a big head in Liverpool, you were cut down.
Right.
And the fact that they had four, somebody asked them, or one of them, or Ringo, or some, you know, Elvis, and I think John said it, you know, the difference really, what saved us from ending up like Elvis is that there were four of us. Mm-hmm. So if any one of us or two of us got a big head, the other three or the other two would cut us down. So we had three other people who knew what it was like to be a Beatle. Mm-hmm. Elvis never had that, and it's sad. It
was, but they had enormous confidence, I mean, even early on, and perseverance. I mean, there were moments, you know, when they were, you know, riding around in the freezing van in England and all this, and you know, they entered talent shows that they lost early on that they didn't, you know, and so there were many, many setbacks, and there were moments where, you know, George, you know, well, should I go back to being an electrician? Do I need to, you know,
Blackler's department store.
Right. And so, but they had very supportive community around them, including their parents.
Yes, yes.
And they also believed in their product. They knew they were good. They, you know, there were so many bands in Liverpool at that time.
It was
like 400 bands or something.
Oh, yeah.
Must
have been great to be a fan.
And
though,
they knew that they were better. And, of course, their time in Germany really
clinched
it for them.
Although, Candy, I beg to differ on some point of that. Although Candy has written a book called Beatleness about George in the anthology said we were bad, you know. For one thing, when he talked to Dick Rowe, who rejected them for the Decca audition, Dick Rowe said, George, you know, I can't believe it. And George said, I agree with you, we were bad. I would have rejected us too. But then George said, we seemed to have this confidence that wasn't, you know, even from the beginning, that wasn't justified by anything we did. But we had this.
They wanted it, and they were persistent, and they made it happen.
But there was also, apparently there's an air war, war siren
there's
going on.
There's a lot of noise.
But, and I've read it in different books. There's one book that really, The Revolution in the Head is a very good book
by
E. McDowell.
Yeah.
Talks about this almost, this somewhat mystical thing that they gave off, and people who met them when the four of them found each other at least at the beginning in Great Britain and America, when they would be in a room, they gave off, and people try to explain what it was, you know, this positive feeling, and when they would leave the room, the people would feel down. They never experienced, so they called it magic. It was just, so it was a mystical thing that went on.
There was a synergy between
the
four of them.
Yes, that just was beyond
anything.
A chemistry,
a synergy, and they exuded a feeling, an attitude, joy, confidence, fun.
Let me just stop here for a second. It's 10 seconds before 5 o'clock. We're going to continue on. This is WMFO Medford. It's Acoustic Ceiling, and we're talking about the Beatles, and when you talk about the Beatles, it's a long and winding road.
The long and winding road.